Hilton for the stay.
I think that's good enough.
Hello, folks. This is Rish Outfield, and you are listening to the Rish Outcast. And this is another episode where I've got a special guest with me. Say hello, everybody. This is, well, everybody. We can't hear you. You hear us. That's how podcasts work. I'm getting used to it. It's only my third episode. I have Abigail Hilton here with me. Say hello to the people.
I assume the thunder will speak for me.
That's right. They should have been warned you were in the studio by the inclement weather. I asked Abby to join me here because recently I did another one of the audiobooks for her book in the Hunter's Unlucky series. And the Hunter's Unlucky was the very first audiobook that I did for her. And was that back in 2013 or 14?
I think that was 2014. Yep.
Okay. And to date, it's still the longest audiobook that I have done, Hunter's Unlucky was. But this one was pretty long. And it's called Arkov's Bright Side. And what installment is it in the Hunter's Unlucky saga?
It is book number 4.
Book number 4 on a series that was only meant to ever have one.
That is true. And the second and third books are pretty short. They're closer to novella length or just like a very short novel. But with book number 4, I took it back to tradition, and it's a chunk. Before we go further, I also just have to say, guys, I know like Rish talks like I don't like what he does or I complain about it. It's so good. It is so, so effing good. He did such a brilliant job on this. And anyway, okay, continue.
Okay, well, I was going to ask you if you knew, even before you wrote it, that Arkov's Bright Side was going to be big, or if it just got away from you.
It kind of got away from me. The first part is about the same length and kind of the same organizational style as Lullaby and Distraction, which were the previous two books. And in the second part, I knew what I needed to do to keep it under control, and I made the conscious decision not to do that. So these books are written from my heart. They are written for fun. They have a very devoted, excited audience, but it is not a big audience. And it's hard to get people into this series because the genre of talking animal books that have a grown-up level of complexity and themes, it's very small. So there's very few comp titles, and people tend to love them once they try them, but it's hard to get them to try them. So these are not commercial titles. They will pay for themselves eventually, but they're slow. So yeah, I wrote this for me and a small audience of enthusiastic fans who are also fans of Rish. They love his voice. They love the way he performed these novels. And yeah, these were books that kind of pulled me out of my pandemic funk.
Well, that's, I guess, going back to what you just said a minute ago, Abigail Hilton, boom. Her name has always been synonymous with doom and gloom on my podcast. But this experience of Arkov's Bright Side was probably the smoothest, easiest experience, where I would send you chapters. And I don't think I got a single email from you where you said you completely misunderstood this scene, you're going to have to do this scene over again.
Yeah,
there
no,
wasn't
no,
any of yeah. that in this well, one.
Not in Distraction or Lullaby either. Yeah, we've worked together now long enough, apparently. Yeah, smooth like butter.
There were parts that were really hard for me to do. And I think we didn't talk about that. This is the second of 3 podcast interviews I think we're going to do. And in the first one, we didn't really touch on my struggles with certain aspects of the books. There was one sentence that I wrote down as I said it. Halvery, this is one of the results of Munchie and Brindlefluff's pairing. I don't know how many times I had to do that line. It was a lot of times. Because it also had to have an English accent, and it had to be a female character. And there was something about Munchie and Brindlefluff that was, it was really, really hard to narrate. But yeah, the process was smooth, and we were on the same page, and that has not always been the case. And so it made the experience a wholly positive one, which is really nice because almost immediately, almost as soon as I was done, you said, well, that's good because I've got another book. When can you start? And so I was almost ready to call you and say, hey, let's not do these other interviews if I'm starting on another book, because that's going to become all consuming and I won't want to talk until it's done. But here we are. We had a couple of hours free between us. And so I wanted to talk to you here on my show in case people haven't listened to our collaborations. Are they collaborations? What would you call what we do together?
It's a bit of a collaboration. I also feel the same way about my visual artists. So sometimes they draw the characters differently than I imagine them. And I'm like, okay, that's their interpretation of this character. It's perfectly valid. It's just different than mine. And then occasionally, I like their interpretation better, or aspects of their interpretation will then seep into my later interpretation of the character. So the voice acting, the way you do the voices is the same way. Like there's some voices that I'm like, well, I don't hear him quite like that in my head, but this is a perfectly valid and good interpretation of this character. And then it's also often the case that later when I'm writing those characters, I will hear your voices for them in my head, and that will sometimes inform the way I write them. I think I said this in the last interview we did, but I originally heard Dazzle as a smooth talker, but also a very fast talker. And you delivered him in a very slow, measured Bond villain kind of way. And there was actually a line in Brightside that I took out on my final edit that said something like, you know, Dazzle said in his usual brisk fashion. And I was like, well, that will sound absurd because of the way Rich delivers his lines. So I'm going to get rid of that. And it did actually change the way I heard the character in my head a bit. So yeah, I would consider this a collaboration because you don't just read the story, you perform it.
And that's something we've talked about really recently. Are my listeners able to listen to the interview?
Yes.
Over on your Patreon. It's open for everybody. Yes. So if they go to patreon.com/Abigail Hilton, is that right?
Yes. And I can give you the link for the show notes if you like.
They can listen to that. But that character of Dazzle, he appeared in the last book, which was called Distraction, right?
Yes.
And I did. That was my note for the character, was Bond villain. He is one step ahead of everybody, and he's super crafty and not to be trusted. But then he shows up again in this book, and suddenly he says things where we think, oh, maybe he's turned over a new leaf. Maybe we can trust him. But I had this Bond villain voice for him. And it made it really, really challenging because there are times when he says stuff that are supposed to sound sincere, that are supposed to sound trustworthy. But how do you do it with that villainous bad guy mustache twirling voice? And I'm not sure if that made the book more enjoyable or less enjoyable for listeners rather than those that are just reading the text. Maybe it's more enjoyable because you're like, well, his words say one thing, but his voice, his tone says something else. You should not trust this guy. Did you struggle with that at all when I was narrating it, when I was sending you the chapters, saying, well, why would anybody believe a word this guy said when he talks like that?
I did a bit. We're probably getting into, well, I don't know how people who haven't heard the book are maybe a little bit confused, but the part before we meet his sister, he meets up with our heroes. There's some mutual cooperation, but it's not crystal clear whether he's really helping himself or whether he's really intending to help them.
That's something through the whole book.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Never have a chapter from Dazzle's point of view.
No.
So we never get into his head. We never know whether we can trust him or not. And there's the Roop character who's like the good angel. And there's the Halvery character who's the bad angel who says, do not trust this guy. Kill this guy while you have the chance. Because he'll kill you the second your guard is down. He's telling the king this. Arkov this. And I love that when I was performing it, because you made me read the book. So
can I interject and say, instead of good angel and bad angel, let's say justice and mercy, because that's really more.
Okay.
Calvary wants justice. Justice and mercy. You know, that... Rip wants mercy.
Oh, that's good. Ultimately, it's Arkov's decision, yeah. But he's got these two advisors, both of whom are sure that they're right. And there are moments when Halvery just like comes right out and says, don't let him say another word, kill him, with Dazzle in the room. And I think yeah. that's amazing. But you never let us know what is going on with him, what his ulterior motives are and all that. And so there is that interesting through line through the whole book. I got to find out whether he's trustworthy or not. And sometimes he seems to be all in it for himself, and sometimes he seems like a super decent guy. And so that was an experience where I had painted myself into a corner, and I had to figure out a way. Because there are times when he says things that are wholly benevolent and almost humble.
Yeah.
But how do you perform that with that kind of, you know, old-time villainy in it, with the way that he does his voice.
To be fair...
Anyhow, sorry about that.
It's fascinating. To be fair, I did tell you that he was going to have some emotional range, and not to paint yourself into a corner too hard with that voice. But I thought it was wonderful.
That's true. You told me that on the last book.
I did. I know. But you would have killed me if I would have said, I'm sorry, you have to read Brightside 2 before you can record Distraction. You would have not been pleased.
Well, and see, I did that same mistake way, way back when I first... What was the first adult Hunters book?
In Hunters, we...
Book where the children were now adults. What was that one called?
Lullaby?
Okay, that was Lullaby, which took place, what, 15 years later?
That's the one where Charter dies. Which is not a spoiler. It says so in the description of the story. Yeah, that's the one where Charter dies, and Arkov takes him to the Ghostwood, and Roop and Halvery come along because Roop is really worried about Arkov, and they have a conversation over the course of that adventure that precipitates the beginning of Distraction. But yeah,
so,
before we move away from this topic, I just wanted to say, regarding Dazzle's voice, the way you delivered him between when he meets up with our heroes and when his sister brings his cats to rendezvous with them, that section definitely, you kept him with that Bond villain voice. And even though the words I had written were sincere, the way you delivered them was not. And I was like, I just don't know about this, because, you know, the emotional arc of the book requires that at some point you start to feel for him, you know? And it's maybe not at that point, but still I was like, I didn't know whether you were going to keep doing it. And right at the point when he actually meets cats that he knows and he has been protecting, his tone changes. He doesn't change. The voice remains the same, but the tone changes. And I really liked that, because that also makes sense, right? Like, now he is talking to his sister. Now he is talking to the cats that he has risked a whole lot to bring here. And the tone noticeably becomes less snide, you know, because he's pretending not to care. Pretending is not even quite the right word, but like, he is intentionally not showing any emotion earlier in the story, and then he becomes a little less guarded. And anyway, I thought that was well done.
Well, you also beat the hell out of this character, Dazzle.
He had it coming.
And the more injured he is and the more tired he is, the harder it is to maintain that. Yeah, I'm sure you wonder why I brought you here today. That voice, you know what I mean? As it becomes weaker and less confident, and you sense the tiredness, and you sense the humanity. I know it's not a human being, but do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That there is a person underneath all of this bluster, because he's always lying. Well, he's lying half the time.
Yeah.
But we don't know which half are true and which half are untrue. And so that is really interesting, and I'm assuming we'll see that character again, and it will be fun to try and keep it going.
Yeah,
The thing that I was going to say about Lullaby was that I made the same mistake in Lullaby when suddenly these characters that were children in Hunters Unlucky were adults. I had to decide how Roop and Halvery would talk, and I gave Halvery, this high-pitched, like, aristocratic, snotty, snide, he rolls his R's sometime voice, and I gave...
That was back in Hunter's Proper, you did that, yeah.
Okay, I did. I doubled down then.
You did.
In Lullaby. And Roop, I chose to be calm and reserved, and he speaks more from the back of the throat. And as I was reading those books, that book and the book that followed and the book that followed, I realized that they really should have been the opposite. Roop is the bleeding heart. Roop is the one that everybody deserves a second chance or a third chance or a fourth chance. And Halvery is just, no, I made my decision and I'm going to stick with it. There's no room for argument.
That did abuse me. Halvery is the more... has got the more dominating personality in a lot of ways too. That did amuse me, but actually it is in character, and it's possible that that informed his backstory just a little bit, because I'm not sure I had decided that he was an officer's cub until I was thinking about the way you did his voice, because and it makes sense that he came from a bit more of a, what the Cretia would consider, an upper class background. Arkov and Roop were gutter trash, you know, as far as like in the hierarchy of Leashwood, they really came from the bottom. They were, did not have a den. They were orphans. But Halvery came from I knew that he came from a den, and I knew that he came from a comfortable den. But I don't know that I had decided to make him an officer's cub until I thought about the way you did the voice, and I was like, okay, let's make his really upper crust accent make sense, you know. So I will put him with that background. But yeah, that I can't say for sure because I don't remember sometimes how things come together. But that the way you did his voice might have been why I gave him that particular piece of backstory.
Okay, well, then yeah, this is a collaboration in that respect. Let me read this thing that I wrote as I was recording it. I wrote, acting is making choices. A lot of times, at least in film and television, you've got a director whose job it is to tell the actor which parts work with his or her vision, which choices are right and which choices are wrong. In this, there's no director in the room. So often, I will perform some of the dialogue two or three or four times, trying it different ways, and ultimately choosing which version I keep determined by my attitude and my understanding of the characters. And every once in a while, especially in the past, you've become that director on certain lines where I was so far from how you meant the dialogue to be delivered that you felt I should do it over again. But not so much lately, and I guess my question is, how hard is that to have to sit back and hear pretty much the finished product completely out of your hands, especially when we've got a deadline or you've got fans clamoring for the finished product either now or sooner than that?
I feel like I feel like our vision is mostly aligned, but maybe I have mellowed. I mean, I don't know. I can't. Maybe I don't see myself clearly. Like, I don't know. Maybe I'm not as picky. Or to me, it feels like there's really no need to change this. There's also the fact that these are pretty established characters in this point. And yes, there are some pieces that are different. But our big conflict in Hunters really was that you didn't want to finish reading the book before recording. And we talked about this too in the last podcast. I feel like we talk about this every single time we do an interview, but it really wasn't that you were, I mean, you were doing an excellent job. It's just that in most of my books, there's stuff that you don't know until the end that has to inform the way you perform the beginning. And this is just the way I write. I don't think that's true in all authors' books, but I do think it's in mine. And you figure that out at this point. So, you know, you don't just start recording after reading three chapters. You're like, finish the book. And I feel like your judgment is pretty good when you know where you're going.
Okay, well, let's go way, way back. You started, tell me when you started writing, and then I will ask you a second question.
So Hunters is a strange book because it was my first book, and then it was something like, I don't know, my 12th book. But yeah, Hunters was my first novel. I finished it when I was 15. Yeah, I was
15.
15 years old. I started it when I was 14 and I finished it when I was 15.
Were you precocious? Were you smart for your age? Or were you just a normal 15-year-old? Like, did your teachers be like, my God, what are you doing? And you're like, I'm writing a novel. Or was this something that you did like in your spare time and you were secretive about?
I was certainly a bit secretive because I was raised in a cult. They didn't like fiction much. So yeah, I was kind of writing at night. I was starting books even when I was like 12, but they hadn't taught us to type yet. And this was not in the time when all children learn to type as soon as they learn to speak, you know. So I was a very, very bad speller, and I still am. The more creative I'm being, the more cut off I am from the part of my brain that knows how to spell. It's like I literally have no access to the part that knows how to spell words when I am in the creative mode. And so that made it rather hard, frustrating for child me to try to, like, I had notebooks that were like holes were erased in the pages because I was trying to write and move things around, and it didn't work very well. But then as soon as they taught us to type in seventh grade, and they had not even finished teaching us all the keys. Like they were going, you know, like row by row or something. And they hadn't even finished teaching us all the keys before I started writing Hunter's Unlucky because I wanted to tell this story. And yeah, I finished it in about a year. I was giving chapters to my little brother who was 10. And now his son, who was 10 last year, I got to give him the recent version of the novel, which he read quite a few times last year because it was a rough year for him. That was very satisfying. But yeah, I was printing it on the dot matrix printer, and I made friends with people by handing them giant notebooks and saying, I think you might like this story. Yeah, I was a very weird kid, but I was raised in a very weird environment, so I don't know what I would have been like if I was raised in a normal environment. Don't get to find that out. But yeah, my teachers certainly did not understand what I was doing. Most of them did not know what to do with me. My parents didn't really want to read, but I was writing. I don't know. I don't know how much you want to hear about all of that. But yeah, I wrote to escape, and I kept writing books all the way through high school and college, and I wrote, gosh, I would have to look and see how many I wrote in between Hunters and the new version. But then when I was about 32, 33, the characters just wouldn't leave me alone. And, you know, they tell you don't rewrite trunk novels. That's a mistake. And it probably is most of the time. But the characters just really would not leave me alone. And so I took out a clean document and I started the book from scratch. And I had my old version there, and I did look at it, I referenced it, but I didn't, like, open the old version and, like, read paragraphs and move things around. Like, I wrote it clean in a clean document, and I pretended like the original version was a myth, and I was going to tell what really happened. So the main characters are all still there, and the basic plot of the story is still there, but I changed a lot of things. I added, switched around, and improved a lot of things, you know, with everything I had learned from writing quite a few novels and publishing quite a few novels between that 15-year-old draft and the 30-something-year-old draft. Yeah, of all my books, it's my stealth favorite. It's not my bestseller, but it does have a devoted audience. And that original novel is absolutely a standalone. You don't need to read any of the other books to, it comes to a satisfying conclusion.
Do you ever have people ask you if they can read the high school version?
I think that would be, no, I no.
Okay.
Oh, have people asked me?
Yeah.
Every once in a while, my brother wants to get it out. And I'm like, buddy, I'll send it to you, but it's not, when you were 10, you were very uncritical, and I promise you that the recent version is many, many, many times better. Morgan, my nephew, you know, he asked about it. I'm like, I don't feel like that's a great idea. I think that you will think less of me if I let you read this. But so if you buy the book on my website, you will get with it my notes that I wrote in real time for the Patreon, because I was publishing this chapter by chapter to the Patreon as I was rewriting it. I made copious notes on what I changed, what was in the original, what I thought of what was in the original, places where I thought the original was really bad, you know, places where I was like, well, gosh, for 15, this was pretty good, you know, places where I was like, well, this was just fucked up, you know, and I had to fix I scrapped all of this and redid it. So I did a bunch of those notes. They are kind of fun to read. So if you, I would never hand anyone the original version, but I do have, It is, I think it's 20,000 words. It's a long document, and it's delivered as a PDF because I made comments on my comments, which are clear in the PDF, but they wouldn't be clear in like an ebook format. So anyway, that is delivered free of charge to people who buy the book directly from me. And I think I also packaged it with Distraction and maybe even Brightside. I packaged it with several of them because there were people that had already, you know, bought the early book. So if you're interested in that sort of thing and like the process of writing something, especially something that got written in such a strange way, then yeah, that document is, I think, pretty entertaining for people who know the novel.
Well, I find that stuff really, really interesting. I don't have that many friends that are, well, I don't have that many friends,
yes,
but I don't have that many friends that are writers. And then you, gosh, you're so young. You're 34. I hope it's okay to tell people that.
I am 45.
And you've been writing forever and publishing for such a long time that I find it really interesting to find out things that changed and things where you had written yourself into a corner as like, how do I get out? And do you go back and rewrite? Or do you just say, no, I'm going to figure it out with what I've written? But your speed is astounding to me. And maybe I'm just slow, but my speed is astounding compared to George R. R. Martin. So it's all relative.
I'm sure you write more words per year than I do, Rish. I'm pretty sure. We can get out our Excel spreadsheets and compare, but you write a ton. When did you finish your first short story? How old were you?
Oh, I wouldn't have finished until like freshman year of high school.
That's pretty darn young.
I started multiple stories, but I was never able to finish anything. I would always lose interest, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Unless it was for a class at school, you know, they would never get done. And I still finish only half of what I start, which is so frustrating. But that's one of the reasons I enjoy listening to you talk about your projects, is because you seem to have an efficiency. And I don't know if that's the word that I'm looking for, but I've not heard you say, I wrote 40,000 words on a novel and then I just tossed it, because I was okay with having wasted all that time.
No, I do finish things. I do think my superpower is mostly finishing things. It actually is not speed. I think you write more words than me. I think that you don't always put them out there.
Well, I mentioned that your productivity is astounding. Before I had finished Distraction, you had already written Arkov's Brightside, or were almost done with it. Before I had finished recording Arkov's Brightside, you said, guess what? There's another book that takes place after this.
Well, I go on these tears, though. Like, right now, I'm kind of in the doldrums, because what I want to do is write yet more Hunter stuff, but I really, really need to write this other series. It's been sitting there patiently waiting for me. And what I really want to do right now is think about writing, which is not, you know, doing any good, as you well know, is like a useless activity for the most part. You know, I need to sit down and do the hard work to get this new series going. But I will go on a tear and write a whole lot for a few months, but I don't maintain that pace. I mean, Big wrote what, like 350,000 words in a year? Last year?
He did.
Yeah, yeah. I've never written, I think my absolute max is like 235.
Well, I think he did that and then he didn't write for a year after that. And it made me wonder, well, did you just burn yourself out?
You can. I mean, I can burn myself. I am definitely capable of burning myself. My speed limit is 3,000 words a day. But I preface that with, I have to be really inspired and I can maintain that for a few weeks. I don't know if I could maintain that for month on month on month. Because I do edit as I work. So I write pretty clean. But every time I sit down to write, I read the last 2 days worth of work and edit it. So every like 3 days, a day falls off, right? And I will not return to that until it's time to edit. So, you know, it keeps me moving forward, but it also means that when I'm ready to edit the book, it's pretty finished. Like I clean it up as I go. But that also means that if I'm writing 3,000 words a day, that every time I sit down, I've got 9,000 words to edit before I can even start. So there's a self-limiting factor there, where if I get going, you know, 4,000, 5,000, 6,000, 7,000 words a day, suddenly I will do nothing but edit one day, because that's just my process. And I have heard other people talk who write, you know, much faster than me. You know, they're writing like 7,000, 8,000, 9,000, 10,000 words a day. But then they talk about how much cleanup they have to do. And I'm like, dude, Like, when I write the end, that book is pretty darn clean. Like, it's 90% done. So I think my way is fine. But then I also tend to slow down between projects. So I don't know how you do all these short stories, because every single one of those would be an opportunity for me to, like, fall off the rails, right? Because a nice long novel, there's no opportunity to, like, lose the thread and stop, and they're like, the end is still beckoning you. But every single short story, there's a great chasm between the end and the next beginning, which would be, I would find that hard.
Yeah, that's not a problem for me, just because I get this rush for finishing a short story that you get, you know, every 3 months.
Yeah.
On a novel, or however long it takes you to write a novel. Yeah. But you know, you can write a short story in a week, or if you're like you, doing 3,000 words a day, you can write 2 short stories in a week. And so maybe the adrenaline, or the, what do you call the little things that go off in your head when you go for a run?
Yeah, the endorphins.
Endorphins, maybe that carries you through to, okay, I want to do this again.
But do you not get the postpartum depression? Because I definitely get that at the end of the novel. Like, you know, for just a few minutes, you're on top of the world. And then you're like, I am rudderless. And my life has no meaning.
See, that's sad. And I think that's a place where you and I diverge. I always tell this story that I went to a writer's conference, and there was a guy who said, I have done a lot of drugs in my life, and I've had sex with a lot of, and then he paused, and then he said, people, but there's nothing that can compare to the feeling you get when you finish a novel.
That's a good feeling.
And I wrote that in my notes, and I was like, oh my gosh, I'm going to write a novel. And I ended up writing my very first novel that year after going to that class. You know, to me, because I finish things so infrequently, even short stories, you know, I probably have 100 short stories that are unfinished, that will remain unfinished when they bury me. Just, it feels so good to actually write the end, that I, you know, I'm chasing that dragon.
And so now you don't have to do a lot of drugs or have sex with a lot of people. You finished a novel and you've done the ultimate thing.
I suppose so. Before we go, I wanted to ask you about audio, though. So the Cowrie Couchers was not your first. What was the first one that you narrated yourself?
Prophet of Panamandora was the first one I narrated myself.
Okay, and we've had this conversation before. You did it yourself and you weren't sure you liked the finished product. We talked about me doing Prophet of Panamandora, but ultimately we decided there's lots of other books and your reading was fine. Do you still feel that? Do you still feel that your reading is fine? Or if you had your druthers, would you have somebody do Prophet?
I don't think my reading is quite professional sounding, but nobody complains about it. And you told me it was fine, so I chose to just believe you.
Okay.
So I was learning to narrate over the course of that book. So I feel like the last book, or maybe even it's a trilogy, so maybe the last half of it, I feel like is pretty good. Like, I'm pretty proud of that last book, but I definitely feel like I was speaking too fast at the beginning, and there was just some things that I was still learning to do. And also, as in all of my books, there's more male than female characters, and I just feel like it would sound better if a guy did it. But people buy it and they don't complain. So I should not redo it. Yes.
Do people complain about Guild of the Cowrie Catchers? Because you did that one in full cast.
You know what? There are people who love full cast, and there are people who really can't stand it. So yes, there are people that complain about that one. I mean, they complain about the gay sex more than the full cast production. But and it's weird because, you know, exactly the same. That's a situation where, you know, somebody will be like, I absolutely love this because it's like listening to a movie and all this stuff. And then another person will be like, I couldn't stand all the different voices coming in and out. The music was super distracting. And then some people will talk about the music being really loud, and I'm like, I don't know what's wrong with your levels on your speakers, but it's not really loud. But I think that's just for some people, you know. Maybe there are some of these people that are like that they don't perceive the world in quite the same way, and like audio noises sound louder to them or something. I don't know. Yeah, I don't, but I do get a variety of reactions on that book, both love and hate for the production style specifically.
I mean, I only know the projects that I have participated in. Like the Mouse and the Snake series.
Oh, yeah. Eva Malachi?
Was that 7 books?
I mean, I think...
Right.
I think you've participated in almost all of my Abigail Hilton projects except for Prophet.
Oh, okay. Well, I wasn't sure if you had things... Because you're always doing a podcast yourself. And you're reading... Are you reading excerpts yourself in your own voice?
I used to, but now I usually just put out the professional audio when it's ready. I don't have time.
Okay. But like little short stories that you write here and there, do you ever record those for your Patreon or for your listeners?
For a while, I went through like a year and a half there where I was letting them vote on a character every month. And then I was writing a story about that character, usually backstory to the related novels. And that was a fun, really interesting exercise. It produced a lot of neat content. I got to experiment with like styles of short stories a little bit, like did some things that I wouldn't normally do. And I was reading those because they were coming out every month and the listeners were voting on them, you know, so they were kind of invested in them. I was reading those, my own version, and it was not an edited version. It was just like a live read, the same way you would get if I came and like attended a conference and you came and listened to me read live. You know, you wouldn't get the edited out. I was doing those that way, but I did that for about a year and a half. And then I was like, okay, I really need to focus on novels because they sell better. And as much as I'm enjoying these short stories, they're taking up a whole lot of time. And also at that point I had a short story about almost every moderately important character from Cowcatcher series and several from other characters from other series. So yeah, I burned out on that a little bit, but yeah, I did for a while.
Is that something that you enjoy doing? Going through and editing your own work? Like the ones where you said are like a conference, that doesn't really count?
Oh, audio editing? I hate it. Just like everyone, yeah.
Right, when you... Let me ask this. Does your hearing your voice bother you when you have to go through an edit and be like, oh, kind of thing? Or do you like to hear your voice? Would you rather Lauren do all of your short stories? Or are you okay with your voice doing the short stories?
I would prefer your voice doing the short stories, but if I can get used to my own voice. I think everybody has to get used to the sound of their own voice. I really have to force myself to slow down because I talk fast, but I can get used to it. Like, I don't think I'm the worst narrator ever. I also don't have a very strong voice. So after about 30 minutes of recording, I'm starting to get froggy.
Okay.
And that's not good.
Yeah, that's definitely something that I've not built my endurance, if that's the word that I'm looking for, on that. After an hour or two, it just, you can tell when you're editing it whether I was fresh or whether I was at the end of a long recording process. It just gets tired. And I, some of the parts, like we talked about this while I was doing it, there's some parts, is it Arakov who's really tired? And so I made his voice gravelier and scratchier than ever. And I couldn't do it after like 10 minutes. Just, I started coughing and I thought, oh shoot. Okay, well, I'm going to have to learn not to do that. Or there's some magical way to not cough when you do that to your voice.
Yeah, you said you were struggling with his voice a little bit. It is quite a deep voice. Then I was worried that you had COVID and that was going to make you unable to do these voices.
That wasn't the case. One thing that's neat about your book is it jumps from POV to POV. And so if Arakov is the main character in chapter 8, somebody else is probably the main character in chapter 9 and allows my voice to recover.
I have related to voices. That's a really rough segue. But should I ask you some travel questions on here, or should we save that for an episode on my podcast? I mean, I'm sure your listeners would be interested.
Okay. Well, yeah, go ahead. I mean, we're talking about voices and performances and stuff. And the people that listen to this show have to have heard the go-to voices that I do over and over and over again. And that's part of what is so fun about doing your books, is because they usually have a huge cast of characters, and I try to make everybody sound a little bit different. And sometimes that's really hard. Like we talked about with the French-accented characters. Like, how do I make these voices sound different from one another? But yeah, go ahead and ask if you've got a question.
Yeah, I do not know how you do it. They all sound really distinct to me, except for that one character that you were messing with me. Apparently, I thought that you would just run out of French voices, but apparently you were like, she's surely going to send this back. Oh, she didn't.
Yeah, it had that funny name. It was Tsuri.
Yeah, he does have a name with like 17 vowels, so I assume you were getting your revenge. Tsuri.
Tsuri. That's right.
Yeah.
But it starts with a T.
Yeah, Tsuri. All the curbs have vowel-heavy names. I don't do many naming conventions, but I had started that with them, and so I continued that. Eow, koal, vowel-heavy. Okay, so I can't remember where I read this. It might have been your blog. It might have been something. Or you may have said it. I don't know. You send out communications in many different forms and many different podcasts, and I get them mixed up. You know, this is why you get texts from me. They're like, you said this somewhere. I don't remember where. Related to this, XYZ. But you said something about you were in the UK and a guy came up to you and wanted to talk, and he couldn't understand your American accent, so you switched into a British accent, and then he understood. That is hilarious.
So, yeah,
could you expound on that?
We were coming back from Paris, and he had just been there. He was from Germany. He didn't speak French, and he'd met with people in Paris that didn't speak German, and so they had communicated in English. And so I said, oh, wow, that's great. And so I was asking him questions, and he just didn't understand what I was saying. And so I did. I upshifted to an English accent. And he spoke to me as though, well, if you had known how to communicate, why didn't you communicate from the beginning? Kind of thinking. He thought that I had been doing like a silly voice or not enunciating or something like that until I did the proper British pronunciation for words. And that surprised me. That was like the only person that I spoke to in English on the whole trip that English wasn't their native tongue. My friend Jeff has been out there for 6 years, 5.5 years. And he said everybody in Europe speaks English, except for in France where they understand it, but they won't speak it. And so I didn't study, you know, I should have done something at least to...
Oh, you were all over the place. There's no... What Jeff should have done was remind you that Google Translate exists, because it works quite well.
I've had people say that to me, but I turned off the data on my phone once I left the country. And so I didn't have any access to that. I couldn't make calls. I couldn't go online.
Oh, no, you didn't have maps?
All I could do was text. And so I thought, well, maybe if I could do it over again, you could.
You didn't have Google Maps?
No.
Oh, man, you must. Okay, so dear listener, I'm just going to say here, speaking directly to the listener, that I am directionally challenged. And everybody who knows me knows this. I was very excited when MapQuest came into existence because I got lost slightly less often. Then, you know, my life changed for the better when things like Garmin and Google Maps came into existence. And Rish has gone hiking with me and seen me put up two different, not one, but two map services, just in case I get lost using one. So when I say that Rish is worse than me, I am saying something. You get lost really, really easily. Oh no, that's terrible. Google Maps is great while traveling. It is so wonderful because, you know, one goes fearlessly into places one would not normally go. So yeah, how often did you get lost?
Well, luckily I had two people with me that would just be my guides. And Jeff's wife, Emily, she had on her phone, she would tell it where we wanted to go and then she would show. And it would say, you know, walk 20 feet. It didn't even do it in metric. It did it in American. And then turn left. And that helped us get to places. There was one time that I got separated from everybody and I was just completely helpless. It was a four-year-old lost in a city of millions of people. But they took advantage of the technology that gets you where you want to go. And I would just follow.
How did they find you?
The tour guide found me. He came back. He told everybody to stay at the statue of Winston Churchill. And he went to find me. And he did. And then he led me back to the rest of the tour. And from that point on, I was like second in line. I stayed with the tour guide the whole time because... but that was in a country where I spoke the language. I can't imagine what it would have been like in Germany or
Oh man, yeah, you get lost in Taiwan. You can't even read the street signs, right? Like you are lost. But yeah, I love traveling. We've had this conversation before. I love feeling like I don't know what anything is, and like, you know, even the dog knows more of the language than I do. And I always get ideas while traveling. You mentioned that you didn't write while you were traveling. I almost never write on a long trip. Like, I'm too busy. Like, my creative brain is completely, like, engaged with what is around me. But I definitely have lots of ideas once I get back, you know, based on stuff that I saw and did. Did you feel like that? Or did you just feel kind of overwhelmed with the whirlwind of stuff you were seeing?
For the most part, I was overwhelmed. We never stayed anywhere more than 2 days. So we were 2 days in France, we were 2 days in London, we were 2 days in Venice, and I rarely knew where I was or how to get places, and I just depended on others to get me a pass for the subway and all that. I talked to my uncle who had gone to Europe over Thanksgiving, and he said that it was so difficult for them to figure out how to get to the airport.
Mm-hmm.
So they took a taxi and the taxi driver took them to the wrong airport.
Oh, no.
Because they didn't know that there were two airports in that town and things like that. Luckily, I was with people that had done it all before. I was like their fourth visitor from the States that had come over. And so that helped. But yeah, everything was so new. And to be places where I didn't know the culture, or I didn't know left, right, east, west, north, and south. That was very overwhelming. And I think you had said, or maybe someone else had said, that I'll get a bunch of new accents that I can use in Abby's books. And I'm not sure if that happened, but I did notice that nobody talks like the characters in the Hunter's books. Everybody's English accents are way more relaxed and lazy, if you will.
Well, you didn't get out into the countryside, though, did you?
No, I didn't. I imagine it would be even lazier pronunciations and harder to understand voices there.
Well, more regional because, yeah, London is definitely a melting pot of different places. But I am not an accent expert either. My brother and I went... The first time we went to the UK, it was right after, I think I had just graduated from college, and I think he was like the summer of his junior year. And we had a very small amount of money that we had saved for this trip. And we went and we stayed for 3 weeks, 1 week in London, 1 week in the UK outside of London, and 1 week in Scotland and Wales. We were like, sleeping in hostels, the kinds of mattresses that my back could no longer tolerate. And we were really counting our pennies. Like we were super mad because this one hostel, they charged like $8 to store our luggage. But then we left early and they wouldn't give our deposit back. And that was dinner. So we're just like, well, now we have to go hungry, you know, so we just had very little money. But it was an amazing trip. It was a super cool trip. And we slept in a train station. Yeah, it was crazy. But in Scotland, I will never forget trying to talk to the gentleman who was running the place where we were sleeping. He was speaking English, right? He was looking right at us and speaking English, and neither one of us had any clue what he was saying. And the terrible thing also was that it was clear that he wasn't understanding us any better. So we were like slowing down and enunciating, and he was speaking louder and louder. And yeah, we were all speaking English, and it was incredibly difficult to understand. So you would have some of those experiences if you went a little bit like further afield within the UK, which I don't know, or to me were fun and interesting experiences.
No, it sounds really, really cool. And I would love to have been able to do that. Just the idea of like backpacking or getting where the road takes you.
Yeah.
You know, you don't have a schedule. You don't have to be somewhere at 8 o'clock. And so what do you want to do? Let's just see where this road goes. That's really romantic to me.
Yeah, it's the hostel beds are not so romantic, and like, but I do think there's actually Oh my goodness, yeah. Especially when you're in a hostel with like early 20s-year-olds and teens, and like people are actually like boning in the bunk beds, and you're like, this is, I wish I could be anywhere else. Please kill me. Somebody's snoring. So that kind of stuff, I am glad that adult Abby will just, rent an actual hotel room. An actual bed that will not make my back sore. But I do think that there is actually something to be said for sticking to a budget that doesn't just let you do anything you want, because often that means that you're having experiences that local people are having. Like, you see more local people when you travel on a budget because you're taking public transit and you're not eating at the expensive American style restaurants, you're eating at the local restaurant. So I feel like actually like limiting what you spend on that kind of trip sometimes is a much better experience, except for the beds, like mattresses, very, very important. Some degree of privacy, very, very important for grown-ups. But yeah, I enjoy those kinds of trips and will plan them very readily. You give me a budget, I'll plan the trip. I was gonna ask you, probably have had too many people ask you at this point, but what was your favorite thing? Do you have a favorite thing? Do you have three favorite things?
Well, I felt like Venice was a magical place.
Yeah.
You've seen it in movies, but it was just different. The fact that you could feel swaying, that it was otherworldly, and everybody got around by boat. They didn't allow cars or motorcycles or bicycles or those awful electric scooters. You walked or you took a boat. I had never experienced anything like that. And just going out and seeing all these other islands, and the islands were all built on, and their houses and stores and tons of tourist traps, on every single one. I'd never seen anything like that. I guess the closest I'd been was Catalina Island off of Santa Monica. But this was otherworldly. And luckily, I spoke a tiny bit of Italian, so I wasn't completely helpless like I was in France and Germany. I could at least count in Italian, and counting is something that is useful no matter where you go. To be able to say due and mean two was really, really cool. Of course, Venice is also great for tourists. I mean, that's their industry, and so almost everybody speaks some English, if not plenty of English. And so I didn't feel quite as, I guess I'll use the word scared, as I did in Germany or France, where it's just like if something happened, I could communicate. And so that's less tense, less frightening, I suppose.
Yeah.
There was a guy in Germany that was speaking to me, and it was German, German, German. And then he said, "You're American? You like Pepsi?" And I was like, "Yes, yes, I do. Thank you. How much?" And he just looked at me, and I said, "A Pepsi? Do you have Pepsi?" And he's like, "Nine." And I was like, "Oh, well, why did you say that?" And Jeff said he was making fun of you. Like, Americans like Pepsi because they're pieces of crap. And I
Oh.
was like, "Oh, okay. All right. No, I'll have nothing then."
You're like, I am that cliche. Yes, please give me the Pepsi.
I am that cliche. Yes. I'm going to call this a night on this podcast. Let people know where they can find your work and your voice. And then obviously the books that I have done for you and I'm continuing to do.
Yes, you can find me on Patreon. It's Patreon/ Abigail Hilton. All of my books now are also on sale through my own store, where I keep like 90% of the money instead of 13%, which is what Audible now gives me. It is really highway robbery. I think that they lie awake trying to think of ways to take money from authors over there, but Rish knows they've just like dialed back what they give you and dialed it back and dialed it back. So I've gone direct with my audiobooks. They're also in many other places that you can buy audiobooks. So if you buy audiobooks from Kobo, gosh, Apple, most of the other audiobook venues, some libraries. However, for the Hunter series, for the two newer Hunter books, I've only got those on my own website for now. And there are reasons for that, which I think will be obvious to you if you start listening to them. But yeah, you can go to abigailhilton.com And then there's a few menu links in the top right, including my store link. And if you buy books direct from me, you will also get some extras. So like the PDF file that has the whole breakdown of like the differences in what I changed, you know, rewriting the book from when I was a child. And I include some other essays. Also, there's interviews with Rish. So Rish's original two interviews back in 2014 after we recorded Hunters, you can download those for free in my store. I've got a number of freebies in my store. So things that I think people are likely to like and come looking for. Also things like the Calorie Catcher's outtakes. There's like 20 minutes of really funny outtakes from Rish and Big and a bunch of other people. So if you enjoyed those books and or you listen to the original podcast, you could download the outtakes for free out of my store. There's also a whole collection of interviews. There's the Calorie Catcher's music that I licensed for that production if you just enjoyed it. So everything is in my store at this point. Also, most of my audiobooks come with the ebooks, so you can buy the audiobook and the ebook bundled, and they are pretty much 100% of the time cheaper than Audible. In fact, they are usually cheaper than an Audible credit. So that's my advertisement for buy them directly from me.
So really, there's no advantage to getting it on Audible.
No, except unless you just like that app. I mean, some people want to keep their library all in one place, and I get that. But the delivery for me is through BookFunnel, and BookFunnel has an excellent app. And I say that as somebody who uses it. It is functionally the same as the Audible app. So that's where the book will show up when you get it through BookFunnel. And it's a reading app, too. So it is just like if the Kindle app and the Audible app had a baby, both the ebooks and the audiobooks show up in there together.
Oh, that's great.
And it's got all the same buttons. Yeah.
So she'll send me the books, the text version in a PDF, and it will have not only a map of Lydian, a map of the island and whose territory is where, but it will always include images of the various creatures. So you can see how big they are and what they look like, because things like Telshis aren't immediately identifiable like a lion is, you know?
I also have to give a plug here briefly for all the fan art on Tumblr. If you go to the hashtag, the Hunter's Unlucky hashtag on Tumblr, there is some amazing fan art. A fan actually made an animation of a fairy shaft trotting. And there's Telshis on there. There's Krisha. In fact, the cover art for Lullaby was originally a piece of fan art, and it was so good that I bought it from the artist, and she tweaked it a little bit, you know, but it's basically the same piece of fan art that she drew. And then I commissioned her to do the covers for Distraction and Brightside. She's from Norway. But yeah, there's a bunch of really beautiful hunters specifically on Tumblr. And I don't know why that property, because none of my other books have taken off on there quite like that book. Calorie Catchers, or the whole like Pirates of Wefervain series, it does have some fan art on there. But looking at the volume of fan art, you would never know that Hunters is not my best-selling series. It really isn't. The Knight and the Necromancer is my best-selling series, which has almost no fan art. But the readers of Hunters are very artistic people. And it's fun to look at.
Well, maybe it's that because it's a fantasy world with beings that don't exist in ours, it lends itself to artists saying, I'm going to show on paper what this would look like. Whereas something much more human-centric, you know, Cormorant, Albatross, those kind of things. We have visuals. You can just type into Yahoo, right? Sorry, Yahoo. You can type it into Bing and do a search. Anything to not use the big bad search engine.
That's probably part of it. I've gotten to know the community on there of people who like xenofiction. That's what they call it. Because I didn't know what to call it.
Say it again.
Xenofiction. So X-E-N-O fiction.
So alien?
So yes, essentially non-human cultures. So quite a few of them are sci-fi enthusiasts. And some of them don't have any books. They've just invented, like, whole societies for these creatures. But they're not human, you know, specifically non-human creatures that have, you know, societies and complex relationships and emotions and, like, stories and stuff. And I would say there is more sci-fi than fantasy, but some of it is also fantasy. And I didn't know. This is the thing, like, authors never really know what they've written. Half the time we don't actually know what genre we've written. I never know what to put those books in. I would call them anthro or anthropomorphic. They don't really fit the furry aesthetic. Like, there's tons of people who like furry stuff, but my characters are very much like Watership Down type characters. They don't have swords or wear clothes or live in a, like, modern world, and so they don't really fit in some of the, like, Redwall, you know, stuff like that. They don't quite fit in with that stuff, but they are a xenofic. Like, once I saw what it was, like, people were talking about, then I was like, oh, yeah, you're right. That is what this is. So there's a bunch of those people on Tumblr, too, and I had no idea they existed or that this had a name, but it does.
Well, your stuff does very well, and that is, judging by my criteria, you know, compared to James Patterson, no, you're not doing too hot, kid. But I'm always impressed when you give me numbers or where you say, you know, this made me X number of dollars during the pandemic. But I'm more impressed by the thing that you just mentioned, where people love it and they grab hold of it and say, this is mine and I want to contribute to it. And lots of times you're kind enough to send me comments that people say over on your Patreon or on Facebook, or maybe they write them on little notes and stick them under your door, that say really nice things about my narration and getting transported into this other world where the characters are tangible and real to the listener. And that always makes me feel like, oh, wow, I accomplished what I set out to do.
Yeah.
I succeeded at least in this one thing.
Yeah, yeah, no, they love you. And I think I felt like for some of the adult content in some of my books, I felt like you maybe thought people were laughing at you. And so I was like, okay, I need to screenshot all of the things people send me about your narration, because nobody is laughing at you. Everyone thinks it's fantastic. And you know, nobody, no author or creative person was ever like, yeah, I've heard enough good things about what I do. I don't need to hear any more of those, like, said no artist ever. So yeah, I try to send, especially stuff that I know you can't see, you know, because sometimes it's a comment on Patreon or it's behind a paywall or something. And yeah, I want to make sure you see them.
Well, thank you. We'll continue this conversation over on your Patreon, so people can go there if they really want to hear us talk about this. There was that aspect we still haven't touched on, is the certain intimate parts of the books. And so there's a tease for part three of this Arkob's Bright Side conversation.
Yeah. So if you go over to my Patreon, the first interview we did is free, and we get into a lot more of the details of the book that basically people who have read the rest of the series but have not yet listened to Bright Side might enjoy. You can listen to that one right now if you want to. The next interview we're going to do is going to have some spoilers in it, and I'm not going to post that one until Bright Side is finished. So right now, I guess I should say that too. I also released all the professional recordings of my books in my Patreon feed. Now, caveat, I don't leave them there forever. So you can't pay $5 and get all of my professional books ever. But at the moment, I am releasing Bright Side. So it is running in my feed at the $5 level. It's posting like 2 episodes per week for the next few months. So some of my listeners, that's how they listen. Like, they don't pick up the audiobook, they just listen to it in the Patreon feed. And once it finishes, I leave it up for a few weeks, and then I take it down. And then, you know, the only way to get it after that is to buy the whole thing. So I will put the interview with spoilers in it. I'm not going to put that one in the feed until the book finishes. For people who have already purchased the book and already listened to it, I will send them an email and they'll be able to download the interview right away. I have lots of freedom because of my store. My store allows me to do all kinds of cool things in terms of like communicating with people that have bought things from me or even coming back. Like I could come back months or years later and be like, hey, everyone who bought Distraction, I wrote this interesting like essay about it yesterday. And here it is, if you would like it. Like I can do that kind of stuff with my own store. And I can't do that for when people buy things on Amazon or, you know, Audible or those places. So that's an advantage of getting it directly from me.
So yet another reason to eschew Amazon and Audible in favor of the... Do you still call it the worlds of Abigail Hilton?
My podcast?
No, I remember going to your website and it said, the worlds of Abigail Hilton. In a weird voice like that.
What else? I don't know what else. It's not like it's one property. Like, I can't say Panamandora or Hunter's Universe or Shattered Sea or... Because there's multiple... properties there. I think now it just is Abigail Hilton, author. I don't know what else to say.
Oh, okay. Well, I wasn't criticizing you. I just, that's what I remembered it being called.
I think the store is, it's easier to tell you to just, if you go to abigailhilton.com, you can get the link to the store. The store is something like shop.abigailhilton.com. Okay, it's not that hard. That would take you directly to the store, bypassing the front page of my website. Like I said, there is free stuff on there, including various Rish interviews.
Okay. Well, we have plugged that. Soon it will be time for me to start on your next book. And I'm sure there will be challenges there and things to talk about once that is done as well. Does it fill you with anticipation? Because the book is pretty much out of your hands. You finished it. And now it's time for the audio book. Is that like frosting on the cake? Or how do you feel about, okay, we're about to start this next audio adaptation? Adaptation? Version?
Well, I always get excited when you guys send me the audio, because it's really fun to see how you've interpreted the voices. Like, I really look forward to that. But as you know, it's like herding cats. I got to get two people to cooperate on this one, so that will be, I've got to get you guys to send the contracts back. You are really good at this point. You will not be the person that I'm chasing to get to send stuff in. And maybe Lauren will be fine too. Lauren's had some challenges lately that are not in any way her fault. But yeah, there's a certain amount of just like wrangling to get everyone on the same page. And then like, because there are two of you, we've got to make sure we collaborate on the voices and make sure that we're not giving characters like two different accents or like super different voices. I don't know. That part always makes me feel a bit anxious.
No, that makes sense. And now I'm feeling anxious because it's been years.
No, it's not your problem. It's not your problem. Like, all you've got to do is like send stuff back. And
like, if you said to me, I'll give you $1,000 if you can tell me what Percy sounds like, I'd be like, oh, shoot, I don't know.
I don't know.
See, I thought for a minute you were going to say, I'll give you $1,000 if I do all of the collaborating and just hand you a finished dual audiobook. And I was about to say, yes, sure, let's do that. I don't want to hear anything else about this. Just send me an audiobook that's done.
Would you be able to do that, though? Would you be able to just step aside and say, I'm not going to be hands-on in this. It's out of my control. And whatever I get sent at the end, I'm stuck with?
Well, the problem is that when I would listen to it, if I did hear something that was like a glaringly didn't agree with like previous stuff we'd recorded or whatever, I'd be like, my fear is I would hear something that iterated through the entire book that was an unacceptable problem. So then, yeah, that's, oh my God, that's a mess.
Oh, that would be like both of us pronouncing character names differently.
And... Yeah, stuff like that. It'll be fine. There's some scenes in this book that I'm really looking forward to hearing in audio. I worked hard on this one. I did write it through the midst of the pandemic, and I was trying to wrap up a lot of storylines. So I'm sure there'll be some there that you'll be like, this is fun. This is my kind of thing. And there'll be some that you're like, I don't know why she did this. Anyway, it's done. That series is done. It's tied up with a bow. the character voices is actually on my to-do list. Like, I have to go through and get samples of all the different character voices. I feel like I can do it faster than you guys can. I really don't feel, I mean, surely, you always tell me thank you, but surely you wouldn't think it was very fair if I was like, hey, here's the old audiobooks. Can you hunt down how you did all these people's voices previously? I do word searches in the document. Because I can remember snatches of lines and stuff, and then I figure out what chapter it's in, and then it's pretty easy for me to quickly hunt down that chapter in the audiobook and to find, you know, that snippet, you know, of whoever's voice. And I feel like I can do that faster than you guys could do it. But yeah, I got to get samples of everybody's voices, and I feel like I probably should get samples from both you and Lauren's versions of them.
Right, like, do our performances of the same characters vary that much?
I don't know. Maybe I don't. Tell me I don't, and I won't bother.
Well, if you sent me Lauren delivering lines of a character, I would do what I could to match that. And that's what you're looking for, right?
I probably should do samples of the girls from her and the guys from you, even though you both end up doing both.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
It does.
But anyway, that is on my to-do list.
Hey, thank you again for the work and for coming on my show. And here we go again, as they say.
Yes, thank you for having me on the show and for giving me fantastic performances of these books. And I think your listeners know that you exaggerate the degree to which we don't get along. But in case they don't, I'm just saying, I think your work is fantastic, and thank you for performing on my audiobooks.
Well, thanks for the opportunity. To be continued. I have been Rish Outfield.
All right, yeah, come on over to my feed for more. There is plenty more, and if you're like wondering what Rish thought right after he recorded the original Hunter's novel in 2014, you can get those interviews right now over on my shop.
All right. Good night, everybody.
The Rish Outcast has reached its end. For now, anyway. And on reflection, I suspect it was produced with some sort of Creative Commons license. Perhaps a non-commercial one. One with no derivatives, but with attribution also. It is my recommendation that you share this file, if you see fit. But do not try to sell it, or change it, or make alterations to it. If that goes well, perhaps you could contribute $1 an episode, or more, to the Patreon fund attached to it, over at www.patreon.com/RishOutfield, to ensure that more episodes are produced. Until next time, podcasts are forever.
And she had picked the death of Polonius from Hamlet, and trying to figure out what dead for a ducat dead meant. Dead for a ducat dead. Dead for a ducat dead. Dead for a ducat dead meant. When she heard her sister come home.
Strabonus's Shemitish bowmen. Strabonus's Shemitish bowmen had wreaked havoc. God damn it!
Flurry says you arrived with only 60 cats, but I assume they're the most vicious pachucas in the monkey tree. But I assume they're the best fighters in Leashwood.
Rube could tell that Halvory liked the sound of that. He particularly liked the idea of forcing... He particularly liked the idea of forcing a confrontation on Mekex, after he'd publicly disdained to parley with Arcove.
Shemitish bowmen had wrought havoc among his knights.
There was undeniably something going on here. I'm not sure I like that. Chingasso. Let me try it again. There was definitely something going on here. Yeah, it just sounds better than undeniably. Before he washed into the branch and managed to get his front hooves over it.
Thank all the friendly ghosts. Especially Caspar. The theory is that Caspar is the ghost of Richie Rich, who died in an ironic accident involving thousands of gold coins.
Sorry.
The good feeling of finishing a story, because I don't do it all the time. It's still the exception rather than the rule.
Rich, are you still there? You cut out. I can't hear you, buddy.
You still there?
Rish.
Did I hang up on you?
You're completely silenced. Hello?
Hello?
Oh, there you are.